This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. This season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
Welcome to Katie's Crib, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Katie's Crib. This week, I'm re-releasing one of my early interviews back from 2018. We'll have a brand new episode up for you on June 23rd. Enjoy the conversation. Bye.
Everybody, and welcome to Katie's Crib. In this episode, we are talking about babies and sleep. Sleep training, scheduling, on demand. We are going to investigate this big and, for a lot of people, a very controversial subject. We have here a friend of mine by the name of Susie Menkes, and she works with a company that she started called Healthy Little Sleepers here in Los Angeles. She's the founder, and she is going to talk to us about sleep training. Hi, Susie.
Hi.
I'm so happy to have you here.
So happy to be here.
Thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. Mm-hmm. I never heard about sleep training. I never knew what it was. And then I had a baby. And then it was all of a sudden all everybody was talking about. Can you walk us through the very simple question of what is sleep training?
What is sleep training? Such a good question. Because oftentimes people don't know about it until you actually have a baby. And there's this thing, sleep training. You have to train your baby to sleep.
Wow.
So it's basically just making changes in your baby's sleep habits so that they can learn to self-soothe. So a lot of times we come home from the hospital, they're newborn, mm-hmm. we're there for them. We're doing it for them.
Sure.
But at some point, and it's typically around 4 months of age, is when their circadian rhythms start coming into play.
What's
and
that?
It's basically their
what
sleep.
Is that word?
Circadian rhythms.
You're smart. Circadian rhythms. Okay.
They're sleep rhythms. Mm-hmm. And it's set by the rising and setting of the sun. And so that's where you get kind of those sleep schedules that people talk about, that 9 and 1 nap and things like that.
Sure.
But really what happens is at 4 months of age is they've become already accustomed to some associations to sleep. So whether you're nursing them to sleep, whether you're rocking them to sleep,
whether they're in a dark room,
on
there's
the go,
a sound machine on,
all of it. So there's associations of all involved with sleeping that they may need to unlearn.
Sure.
And learn to self-soothe.
Right.
And so that's where we come in and try to do sleep learning for them.
And by self-soothing, to clarify that, you mean like the baby, he or she has her own tools to put her or himself to sleep.
Right. So sleep is a science, right? So mm-hmm. it's a balancing of hormones. Melatonin is a sleep hormone that we produce. Mm-hmm. And we don't really start producing it until we're 3-4 months of age. So that's where you get that day-night confusion before that. They're up during
yeah,
night.
Guys, in case you didn't know or you were freaking out, babies come out and they lived in a dark place for 10 months. And then all of a sudden we're telling them like, oh, the sun's down, the sun's up. But they have no idea. And a lot of babies, even when they first come out, which I didn't know until I was going through it myself, it's reversed.
Right.
So they could be up for some reason. Wow, they are napping the hell out of this day. But at nighttime, it's like the most energy you've ever seen.
Right.
And it's because, like you're saying, until month 3 or 4, they don't know. They don't go by the sun yet. They
right.
don't go
they
by
don't have
our
those
normal
rhythms yet. They don't produce melatonin. The one thing that we do is produce melatonin. And right. So melatonin in our breast milk is actually highest in the evenings. So if you are nursing, you have that benefit to give them nighttime breast milk.
I am for the night. Mind blown right now. I love Katie's Crib selfishly because I get lessons like in motherhood on the regular, which is so great. Wow. Okay. Why do you think sleep training is such a controversial and heated topic amongst parents?
It is. It's often misguided sometimes by like a fear tactic. Don't let your baby cry. Mm-hmm. And there is that kind of almost like breastfeeding. Yeah. There's that controversy of to breastfeed or not to breestfeed.
Yeah, stigmas attached.
Judgment.
And, yeah, like this makes you a good mom. This makes you a bad mom. Sure,
and
sure.
If you're going to let your baby cry, you're harming your baby. Right? There's a level of stress that's involved in learning a new tactic. But the American Academy of Pediatrics is something that we follow as sleep consultants. And they actually put a framework together of stress that's really a good guideline to think about stress and what you are doing or not doing for your baby, right? So there's a positive stress response, which is a typical frustration, struggling, starting daycare. All those are typical stress responses. Mm-hmm. There's a tolerable stress response, which is more of something that's not every day, maybe a divorce, a death in the family. Mm-hmm. And then there's toxic stress response, where you don't have a loving caregiver. There's abuse, there's neglect involved, right? So those are that toxic level is what we're talking about being harmful and damaging to the brain.
Sure.
That's not what sleep training is about, right? Right. And plus,
you're not equating sleep training with abuse, right? Okay.
So that's where this kind of misguided information comes from of sleep training is involved with levels of stress. Yes, they're learning a new habit. And it's hard for any of us to change something. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of dealing with that. You have a stable environment. You have a loving caregiver to help you cope through that stress, right? We don't say, here, go learn how to sleep and walk away, right? One, we do it for them first. Mm-hmm. We do it with them. Mm-hmm. We watch them do it, and then they do it on their own.
Whoa, guys. That was just like a real smackdown. Yeah, I definitely personally had... You know, I went back to work when Albie was 7 weeks old, and for me, sleep was literally like a number one priority list because I couldn't memorize my lines, show up at work, look remotely like I was a sane person and not like a garbage bag, and not get my sleep. And so I remember the first times I, you know, was told it's okay to let him make annoyed kind of cryy sounds for 2-3 minutes. Wait a minute, let's see what he does. And he's going to start to teach himself, find his thumb, or if you're a pacifier person or whatever it is, find tools with which to put himself to sleep. And I did have those thoughts for a minute of like, am I subconsciously damaging my baby that he's going to be in therapy for a million years because of me because I let him cry for 3 minutes? And you're saying that is a stress that is not damaging.
No. Plus he's in a stable environment.
Yes. Oh, I was watching that monitor like a hawk and counting down the seconds.
And you're there when he wakes up.
Of course.
And you're there to feed him, love him, play with him.
Yeah.
You know, he's in that environment. You're building that secure attachment in those first 4 to 6 months. So that's what you're doing.
It's good to hear that I haven't damaged him.
And I think there's also controversy. Right. And I think there's also controversy in that if you do sleep train around between 4 and 6 months, that there is that stigma of that you're harming your baby.
Yeah. It's too soon. He's not enough weight. What do you say about those sort of situations? Is there a set rule of when, how much weight, all these things? And again, I don't really know what I'm talking about. These are like literally rumors that have flown into my head from other moms.
Typically, I always say, go by your pediatrician. Yes. Where are they on the spectrum in terms of weight-wise? Are they in 50%? Are they gaining weight? You know, if they're born early, sometimes you have to wait a bit longer because you really want to go by their developmental age, which is based on their due date, not when they're born.
Right.
So if they're early, you might have to wait another 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Sure.
Pediatricians often have kind of a 14-pound rule. Mm-hmm. If I get a client with a 12, 13-pound baby, but they're feeding well, they're gaining weight, I'm not going to turn them away. Because they are developmentally ready. They are producing melatonin. Their circadian rhythms are in place. They do have social smiles, which develop around 6 to 8 weeks of age, which is a prime example of when to set routines in place. Because Social smiles is a connection. They are making connections and associations.
Interesting. Can you talk to us about some of the different methods of sleep training that parents use? Is there a particular one that you recommend? Does it depend on the baby and the issue at hand?
So there's no one particular method that I use. I often take a look at the baby, and you know, the parent is the expert on their baby, so I get a lot of information from the parents, their age, what's been going on before, anything has been tried before, how long have they tried it. I've been trained by the Family Sleep Institute, which doesn't have one particular method that we are trained in all of them. Okay. And it's sometimes a combination of them. There's a Ferber method, which is like a check and console. There is the sleep wave by Kim West, I believe. There is Cry It Out, which is extinction, where is the true cry it out. You put your baby in your bed, in their crib, you leave the room, you come back the next morning. Assuming there's no night feeds.
Wow,
assuming
that is
hardcore. Which you still can do sleep training with a night feed.
And that's the one that moms say, like, they did that for two or three nights and then they never did it again. Like, is that true? I didn't have to do that, so I don't know if I would even be built of the stuff that could do it.
It's not for the faint of heart. Like, I did it.
Wow.
With my first.
Wow. How many nights did it take?
Two.
And how long was the crying? Do you know? Or did
30
you just
minutes. No, I opened a bottle of wine, and I cried and watched the monitor, and in 30 minutes, he was asleep. The next night, it was like maybe 10 minutes.
Okay, so that's the cried out method. What's the Ferber?
Ferber
method. What is that?
So that is a check and console. So you put your baby down to sleep. He starts crying. 5 minutes, you go in and check on him. You don't pick him up or her up. You say a little, it's okay, we're here, it's time to sleep. And you leave the room.
Okay.
And then you can wait 10 minutes. And then you go in after 10. I mean, it can be another five. You can do a variety
of... Right, you do a couple nights of like going in every 5 minutes and just using your voice and your presence to console them, but you don't touch them. Mm-hmm. And then the next two nights or whatever it is that's comfortable for you, then you might extend to, you wait 10 minutes before you go in the room.
Exactly.
I have a friend that did that.
Exactly.
And then what's the other method that you said?
There's a chair method. Which is a little bit more gentle approach. So you're in the room with them. It takes a little bit longer in terms of, you know, getting out of the room and being able. So you start next to the crib.
In a chair.
Your baby's crying. In a chair or on the floor.
Right.
It's like the chair method.
Right.
And you're there. You can, first couple days, you can use your hands on them, but you don't want any, like, any other rhythm involved because you don't want to start another association for them to get attached to. So you keep it minimal interaction, but you're there for them. And when they fall asleep, you leave the room. When they cry again, you come back into that position and you do the same thing.
Whoa.
Without picking your baby up.
Wow. And
then you slowly move the next 2 days. You're maybe in the middle of the room. Then you're not doing touching. It's just your voice. The next 2 days you move again. And maybe you're 3/4 of the way to the room. Then you're at the door. Then you're outside the door. And then you're kind of like slowly.
Mm-hmm. Slowly introducing that they are safe in this space. That you are here.
Yep.
Until I'm not here physically, but I am here.
You can hear me.
But I am here. Whoa. This is all. God, motherhood. You got to be a beast. Like, this is so. So fascinating. Do you have any advice for what parents can say when, I don't know, I do feel like this is like breastfeeding, like you brought it up already. It's just a very judgy topic. Mm-hmm. I can remember very early on, like, my baby was sleeping through the night at 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. Or like the other version, which is like, oh my gosh, I honestly do not believe in sleep training until they are 6 months of age and 15 pounds, and that is cruel to be doing. I've heard all sides of the spectrum, and people are not afraid to give their opinion and their advice. So what would you suggest for parents that are, I don't know, might have, that are picking whatever it is they're picking and how to stick with it? Or
I think finding the support, whether it's their husband, their friend, their family. Sometimes family has different opinions, though. I've had clients who was like, I didn't tell my mom I was doing this or my dad I was doing this. And there's the mom and dad calling and I'm at their house and they're not picking up. And then she's saying, oh, shoot, my sister probably told them and that's why they're calling. You know, they know you're here.
Wow.
So they got to find where they can find that support.
Sure.
And sometimes that's me.
Right.
I work with families on a 2-week period when they hire me. So I'm there for them for 2 weeks.
Oh, so that's how it works with a sleep consultant. You get hired for a 2-week period. And you work with that family closely, and hopefully in that 2 weeks you see a bunch of improvement as far as sleep is concerned.
Exactly.
Yeah, I have to say sleeping, even to this day, is probably the only really touchy subject where Adam and I, my husband and I, we really sometimes butt heads, which is when we put the baby down and he's making fussy sounds. It's like someone screaming in my head. Like, it's so loud to me that I'm not going in there, and the seconds go by like years. Mm-hmm. And my husband just has a way higher threshold for, like, it's only been 15 minutes. He's going to put himself down. He always does. He does it every night. He's going to put himself down. And I'm like, no. Tonight is different. It sounds different. It's just taking forever. And to be clear, he's going, He's not screaming, crying at all. Right. He's either has gas or he's like getting tired and expressing himself.
Right.
But I have to say, even to this day, that is a husband-wife dilemma for me, for our family.
Absolutely. And I work with couples that way, because there are differing opinions about what to do, and kind of coming to an agreement and a middle ground and having that plan.
Yeah.
And being able to have that plan for both of them to work off of, and on caregivers too.
So you're like a therapist too.
Yes. The
middle woman. Yes. So at what age would you say a sleep routine is established?
So I touched on this earlier, around 6 to 8 weeks.
Wow.
Just a routine.
Right.
Not sleep training. Not,
right.
We're not trying to get them to sleep on their own. But they are, when you see social smiles, they are making connections. So when you put those pre-bedtime routines in place, it's their sense of routine and structure that sleep is around the corner.
Right. And that's when was told, like, this is when you might introduce a bath routine, and then like a song or a book, or the lights change, or the white noise sound comes up. But you get into this like sort of ritual routine that they can associate with, now I'm going to sleep for the night.
Right. And naps too. You can do a shortened version for naps.
I do.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it helps increase that melatonin levels, because their bodies and their mind are already getting ready for sleep because those routines are starting. And so that melatonin is starting to get produced.
Great. Is it ever too late to start? Like, do you ever get phone calls from babies that are not sleeping through the night at 1.5, 2?
Yeah. Oh, it's never too late. It's a lot easier when you start early, because you just have certain patterns and rhythms, right, that are in place.
Sure.
So when you start sleep training a little bit later, there's just a little bit bigger of an adjustment.
Right.
Maybe a little bit more protest, because they're verbal. So you put...
Oh my God, I can't even imagine.
So...
What are the benefits of sleep training? And, you know, if I was playing devil's advocate here, are there benefits to just reading the baby's cues and just letting the baby sleep when they're ready?
Sure.
That's probably like nails on a chalkboard to you. But no, explain.
No, I mean...
For our listeners and viewers who are like truly... Because there are so many stigmas attached. Like,
sure. So sleep training is important both for the parents and for the child, because sleep deprivation is hard on us. We can't function as well. We're going to fight more with our partner. We're going to be testy during the day. We won't remember things as well. We don't already have pregnancy brain.
Mom,
like, it's going to be
brain.
Like brain. Mom yes. brain, not
yeah.
pregnancy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, same thing. It's
yeah, it continues. So, and what happens in sleep, especially in the first 4 to 5 hours of sleep, is non-REM sleep. It's the most important sleep we get. It's when our brain shrinks and our toxins are flushed out. So that sleep is most important to get consolidated, which is get them to sleep from like 7 to 12. And then that's when we say, if you're still having a feeding at night, have it after midnight.
Whoa. Okay, I was doing that in the early days. Okay.
Yeah.
So sleep training, you would say, is so beneficial because it's important to get them to have quality, uninterrupted sleep. That's where their brain develops. And mm-hmm. also so that we don't just jump off a crazy drain of insanity, because it's just so hard to be. I mean, I've never been so sleep deprived my whole life. I thought I was going to lose my mind.
Yes. And on the flip side, mm-hmm. right, just following your baby's cues,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So that works great if you have a flexible sleeper. And sometimes you just fall naturally into that pattern. Mm. And that's when you get like, oh yeah, my baby's sleeping at 8 weeks. You're like, great, you have a unicorn baby. Thanks a lot, you know?
Right.
But it goes hand in hand, right? So the parenting style and the baby's flexibility just matched up, and they got into a good rhythm.
Right.
And it happens naturally. And so they're able to follow those baby's cues. Sometimes babies have colic. Sometimes they have reflux. Sometimes the parents are working. So there's a lot of other things juggling. And to follow your baby's cues necessarily doesn't always work.
Yeah, that was my case. Like, I remember going back at 7 weeks to work and emailing my nursing schedule to Carrie Washington, where, because she was the director of the episode, and I had to feed Albie at 6, 9, 12, 3, 6. And I had to know that he was going to be waking up from his nap at that time, that I was going to be allowed to go back to my trailer at that time to feed my kid. So for me, it really helped knowing that he naps from 8:30 to 10 in the morning. At 10, I feed him. Then he naps again from 11:30 to 1. At 1, I feed him. And then he napped again. So in the morning, you know, so the early stages, it was very helpful. Now it's funny that I find that I'm off and he's in a routine already. His naps are sort of changing. And I've become far more flexible in sort of experimenting, like, not waking him up from a nap and seeing how long he goes, because I think he's trying to tell me something, that his naps are, maybe we're going to drop a nap, maybe one, you know, we're going to go from 4 naps to 3 naps to 2 naps, you know, so, mm-hmm. but I'm also off. So I have some of the, you know, it really, you're right. It depends on the schedule.
Right.
And what your baby thrives on.
Right. And he's already in a great routine.
Totally.
So you have that kind of, okay, well.
It's time to go to, he knows, I have the whole setup, right. The whole aura vibe of his room is totally set and ready for crib.
Blackout shades. She's got a Marpak dome.
Oh yeah, guys, we're in Albie's crib right now. My crib, Albie's nursery. But yes, and I do carry those things around with me. Now I've gotten so confident that we've that he's a good sleeper right now, that we are able to, we black out his stroller and we have a traveling sound machine. And so if I am on the go and can't move my schedule things around, he will take his nap. It's not as good. No. And I don't want to do it all the time. But when I do, he knows it's time.
Exactly.
Can co-sleeping be a part of sleep training? Are they mutually exclusive?
Co-sleeping is another controversial topic.
Co-sleeping, so you guys know, means sleeping in the same bed as your parent, mm-hmm. as the mom or dad, correct? Or and the baby, blah,
correct.
Blah, blah. You get me.
Correct. So, again, we go by what the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends. And part of their rule of having the baby in your room till 1 year of age was to encourage, you know, the ease of breastfeeding and taking care of your baby and reducing the risk of SIDS. Co-sleeping with a newborn and a baby under a year of age is not safe. Mm. So instead of co-sleeping, we want to think of it as room sharing, mm. right? You can have a co-sleeper that's mm. attached to the bed, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but you're not going to roll over onto the baby.
Right.
So it's really about reducing the risk of SIDS, and that's something we can control because there's other things that we can't control, like developmental periods. And maybe something they're thinking about SIDS is that it is biological. Mm. So we can't control that, but we can control all these external factors.
Sure.
So if I have a co-sleeping parent, if they're over 1 year of age and the baby, and you know, if that's the setup they want to do, I can work with them. But I really try and encourage room sharing. And sometimes room sharing is a necessity because of another baby, or they live in New York
just
and they're in
estate.
An apartment.
Yeah, of course.
So kind of working around, maybe they're in a studio apartment. I've done that too.
I just took my first trip where Albie hasn't slept in my room in a long time. He's 7 months old and he was in my room, and every 2 minutes I heard a sound and I thought something was happening. It was insane.
Yeah.
You say you do a 2 week period with the family. Is mm-hmm. that how long sleep training typically takes?
Again, it depends on the method, right? So the chair method will take up to 10 to 14 days just mm-hmm. in terms of your process of removing the room, leaving
what you can
the
deal
room.
With. Right.
Right. But that's not to say your baby might be sleeping way before that. You might sit there for 5 minutes and then leave by the
All right. It could be all done
day.
In 2 days, 3 days,
right.
5 days. It's, wow, right. it's a case-by-case basis mm-hmm. of how long it typically mm-hmm. takes.
And it also depends on how consistent the parents are. So consistency is a real, real big component because maybe there a visitor comes, and I always say, no visitors, no traveling, no this, no that. But things, life happens, right?
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I always get calls like, oh, no, I messed up. Well, that's okay. Let's reset, right? It just might take a little bit longer.
Right.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Calendar. Let's be real. Running a household can be exhausting and chaotic. And finding the perfect Mother's Day gift, it's not exactly a no-brainer. Until now. The Skylight Calendar is the best way to organize the family and give everyone, especially mom, some peace of mind to enjoy the things that matter most. The Skylight Calendar is a smart, touchscreen calendar that keeps track of and manages the chores, dinner planning, groceries, and to-dos for the whole family. The Skylight Calendar automatically syncs each family member's digital calendars and displays them all together on one color-coded touchscreen. It even doubles as a digital picture frame, so you can finally share all those special moments that are just sitting on your phone. As a limited-time offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Calendar when you go to skylightcal.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTCAL.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightcal.com/easy.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
How do you wean a baby off of nighttime feedings in order to get a longer chunk stretch of sleep?
Mm-hmm. So, again, so the first feeding, we want it after midnight.
Right. Because their brain's going to develop, if they go down at 7 p.m. and they sleep till midnight, that's a great 5-hour developmental chunk.
Right.
Okay.
And then you can do it a couple ways. You can push the time out. So let's say two nights in a row they made it to 12:30. Mm-hmm. Okay, tomorrow night let's try and make it 12:45 or 1 o'clock.
Okay.
So you can push it out that way. You can also reduce how much time wise or ounces.
That's what I did.
And kind of push it out that way. So their stomach is less full.
Right.
So they're not used to sleeping on a full stomach.
That's what I did. So it took forever, but it was like what worked for me, which was I would pump, and then that bottle that would happen at 1 o'clock in the morning, it was 5 ounces, then 4.5 for three nights, then 4 for three nights, then 3.5 for three nights, then 3 for three nights, then 2.5, then 2, then gone.
Exactly.
Okay, great.
Good job.
Thank you. I'm not like a freak about sleeping, but I'm always like, he's not eating enough. Like there's this weird, you'll see, like as moms, just every single thing is like anxiety induced. Yeah. I'm just like,
it's like
I'm starving and he's not working. He's not eating. It's like, he's not eating at 1 a.m. and 4. And I had to do that. First I dropped the 4 a.m. feed. Then I dropped the 1 a.m. feed. And then magically it happened. And then I felt like a human being. Is nap training and sleep training same, different? Do you do the same thing at the same time? Tell me.
I typically like doing them both at the same time because sleep comes together much quicker that way. Because when you don't get good naps,
get good nighttime sleep. They directly related?
They can lead to nighttime wakings.
No, thank you.
So I do like working on them together. That doesn't mean they also can be separated. So you can work on night, if you're going to do one first, you work on nighttime first because it's the easier of the two because naps are harder to come together because they're a lighter stage of sleep.
Got it.
So even when you're working on them together at the same time, naps still might be wonky a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the more practice you give your baby for napping, the more it will come together.
What are the early, I don't know, mistakes that parents make with sleep training?
Stopping too fast, saying it's not working on day two.
Oh gosh, I'm so that is me. I ended up working out in the end, but good thing, Adam. You know, I always feel like it takes a partner to be kind of stronger than the other to stick with it, not give in too soon, not just quit too early. So it's really perseverance and stamina and
having a plan. Write it down. Even if you're not working with someone, put a plan down on paper. This is what I'm going to do on night one. This is what I'm going to do on night two.
Oh, that's really helpful. It's like writing down your New Year's resolutions.
Keeping yourself accountable. Tell somebody about it.
Right. Takes a village, guys.
Takes.
So you had already mentioned this, and this is big on me, but what happens when you might have gotten a lot of these routines into place, and then all of a sudden something does come up. Travel, illness, somebody's come to visit. It just throws off everything, and you kind of get through it, and then you come back when you come back to it. Is that kind of the deal?
Yep. You come back when you get home. You pick things right back up where you left off. Waking them up in the morning to reset their circadian rhythms if you've been traveling.
Yeah, guys, I'm going on a trip, and I am fully freaking out about the time difference because I have a great schedule going on and a great sleeping baby, and I'm like, what am I doing? But see, I am of this person of like, I'm two ways. Like I'm sort of a hippie and down for like whatever, and it's my life and I want to live it and I want to grab it by the cojones. But I also am like, but we're on a schedule and he sleeps through the night and like, what am I doing?
He'll get back. It's a muscle. He knows it and he'll come back to it.
And it's a personal choice.
Yes.
It's like, you know,
you basically just go back to whatever training method you had going great for you from before.
What do you suggest for people who, like you say, the partner's involved, nannies are involved, grandparents are involved, you know, any sort of other help? I'm sure it's so important to get everybody on the same freaking page.
Yes. Have your schedule laid out.
Everything's got to be written down.
If you're a schedule person, have your schedule laid out.
I had it printed all over my trailer.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot of different... It took me a while to find a nanny I very much trusted. And so at the beginning, it was my husband and it was friends who were also nannies when I was a nanny and people I really trusted because I was having a hard time leaving the baby alone. Mm-hmm. And I had to write everything down.
Yeah.
And really hope that everyone stuck to it. What are the common myths, stigmas, all this stuff about sleep training that you want to dispel, Susie, right here, right now?
We talked about one already, that you're harming your baby if you let them cry.
Thank you for telling me, because I even still worry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I'm like, I think about those early days of like letting him cry for 3 minutes and just being like, because you know what? I just went away with my mother. God bless her. I love her so much. But I put the baby down. And he was whining and complaining for a couple minutes. And my mom was horrified, like horrified that I let him do that. And she'll be the first to admit, oh, Katie, I let you sleep in the bed for whatever. I never let you cry a day in your life, you know. And so we have differing opinions there. But I have to admit, I totally caved and went in and got him and rocked him. And I like never rock him to sleep. But like my mom felt the pressure and I felt the judgment of it. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're totally right. We're on a family vacation. He's upset. He should never be upset. I'm a horrible mom. I'm hurting him. I went up and I rocked the baby. And he went to sleep in my arms and like, I don't ever do that. Yeah. So
the smallest comment will make you do.
Yep.
The strange, for a stranger, I remember being in baby gap and my little girl was taking a nap and I was like, all right, here comes her 45-minute sleep cycle. She starts crying. Grandma in front of me turns around and says, I think she needs to burp.
Oh, you're like, and I'm like, how do you know?
And I'm like, okay, I'm like, everything. I'm like, God damn it, I gotta unbuckle her now and like pick her up. And right. I did.
And you did.
I did.
Oh my God, we don't even know this person.
No.
Oh, you guys, being a mom is so weird and hard and a study in being strong on your own and sticking to your convictions. And oh my gosh, it's so insane.
So another one.
Yes, what else would you like
to
dispel?
That your only option is cry it out, that it's involved in like, just letting your baby cry.
Right. So you're saying if that's something that just freaks you out, that doesn't mean that you necessarily can't still achieve getting some sort of sleep schedule in place.
Right. And timing is a key component of it. Like you can get your baby down if the timing is right and you're processing their sleepy cues and getting all the things in line, that can go down without crying.
Oh, yeah.
It might take a little bit, but...
I watch my baby like a hawk. As soon as I see like yawn 1, 2, 3... I'm like, we got nap, baby. We got nap, and I'm going to catch him before the breakdown happens. But, like, I know when I've crossed over into breakdown land where I missed, I was doing whatever, and I didn't see the cues of the rubbing eyes and the yawning and whatever, and now we're into full-blown bye-bye, and now I know it's going to be so much harder to get him down.
Right.
This is so, so, so all interesting, and I think that that's very helpful to know for moms who might be super turned off by the stigma attached with crying it out or feel really upset about babies crying and their own baby crying, that there are options, like you've said, the Ferber method. And what was the other one?
there's chair method. There's a sleep wave. There's hug it out. There's other
hug it out.
We didn't talk about
that. Yudel, what's that?
So it's another gentle version. So you have a baby that's standing.
Mm-hmm. And they want out of the crib. I haven't gotten there yet, guys. I am scared. Okay.
It's similar to chair, but you don't pick up your baby, but you kind of go over and you just kind of like, I'm here.
Hug.
Yeah. And then they'll slowly calm down with your calmness and they'll lie down. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So I did hug it out with my daughter at some point when she was standing because she was sleeping very well. And then, you know, some developmental things, she got scared.
So that's also a thing where you might have your sleep thing down and then all of a sudden rolling over is new. 4 month sleep regression is new. We're standing. Now we're pulling ourselves over the crib and we are MacGyvering and matrixing our way down the side of the crib. I'm so scared for that to happen, by the way. I'm like...
That'll be another episode.
Oh, good. Then I had a friend who, when her son got the big boy bed, he kept running out of his bed drunk with freedom and getting into their room every single night, like in the middle of the night whenever he woke up. And they put a gate up.
Yeah.
And then he would scream, cry through the night on the other side of the gate and say, I'm bleeding. I'm hurt. I need to change my shirt. I'm all wet. I mean, not true things.
Right.
And I just have a vision of my friend and her husband holding each other, sobbing to stay strong and not go because he had to walk his own self back to his big boy bed and put himself to sleep.
Right.
Oof, guys, this is not for the faint of heart.
No.
Being a parent, whatever method you choose, just getting through the night and everyone having sleep, it's safety, guys. Like, there were moments, you're driving behind a wheel of a car, you need sleep.
Yes.
So we've talked a little bit about the benefits of sleep training for the baby developmentally, but also I'm sure you probably see huge leaps and bounds in parents themselves when they get sleep.
Yes. We're able, when we get sleep, we're able to be more responsive to them versus being reactive. Because when I don't get sleep, I'm snappy.
For sure.
And I don't need to take it out on them just because they're having a tantrum over something and I blow up at them because I'm tired.
Right.
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 So getting sleep in line, not only for them, but for you is really important. So you can parent better too.
And get behind the wheel of a car. And drive them somewhere.
Yes.
Or just yourself.
Yes.
But yes, it's sleep is, I had never gone without sleep in my entire life. Anytime I'd had like a crazy night, all nighter in college to get a paper in or something, I would sleep the next day. Or anytime those early 20 years where I partied really hard or whatever, I would sleep the next day.
You didn't have to do anything.
No. And when I brought my son home, I, for the first time in my whole life, went 3 nights without sleep. And my husband said, I was saying crazy things, like literally crazy things. I was scared. Like I really enjoy sleeping. I like napping. I like my 8 hours. And sleep was like all of a sudden the most important thing. And I'm so happy to know you. There are tons of different options with figuring out what a parent is comfortable with for themselves and for their baby and for their family.
Exactly.
But what we know is that sleep is muy importante.
Yes. And that's what I do too, is building a relationship with the family to understand them.
Sure.
And, you know, are they working? Are they not working? Mm-hmm. Who's taking care of the baby during the day? What type of schedules do we need? Mm-hmm. Kind of putting it all together. Are they going to daycare? Are they going to preschool? Mm-hmm. What do naps look like there? What are their philosophy? Kind of putting it all together for them so that they can have a plan of what to do when they do get home, or maybe they're not getting home in time. So it's really tailoring it to
each individual case. Mm-hmm. Susie Menkes, you are awesome. Healthy little sleepers, you guys. Thank you so much for all of your time and your information.
Thank you.
And for talking about babies and sleeping.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. It was a pleasure.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for The Eligible Bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
Hi, you guys. I am so excited today because my dear friend Abigail Morgan is here, and she is not only a very good friend, but she really helped me through a very rough time in my life after my miscarriage. It took me months to get a regular cycle back. It took me months to feel like myself again. Abigail was the person that stuck needles in me lovingly every single week. I got pregnant. And I also went to Abigail every week of my pregnancy, and she visited me at home after I gave birth. So not only is it like acupuncture, but you were a helper and spiritual help to me mentally, physically, pre-pregnancy, throughout my pregnancy, and after my pregnancy. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Explain a little bit about what you do, and then we'll move into all of the awesome stuff you do to with your own children, because
sure.
You are a mother of two.
I am, yeah. So I'm a licensed acupuncturist and herbalist, mm-hmm. Board certified in traditional Chinese medicine in the state of California. So what that means is that I have a master's degree in traditional Chinese medicine, a master's in science, and I am a primary care physician in California. So I have to diagnose using, you know, biomedical codes and let's say, you know, IBS or dysmenorrhea, painful periods or
wow,
you know, migraines, whatever it is, and understand what that means from a Western perspective, but then also diagnose and treat according to Eastern medicine or traditional Chinese medicine. I specialize in reproductive health. So I have an additional board certification from the American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine in integrated reproductive health.
And it is Float Chinese
yeah,
Medical
my practice
Center.
Is Float Chinese Medical Arts.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Float Chinese Medical Arts.
Yeah.
And you, when you're not busy doing that, you are a mom of two.
I am. Yeah.
And they are how old?
My kids are 7 and 9.
Amazing.
And they're, gosh, almost 8, almost 10.
Great.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to you a lot about when we started to get close, we were working together throughout my pregnancy. I was, and still am, very fascinated in the way in which you raise your kids, which I think is great for this episode. And I would love to talk to you about how you raise them, really, like through sleep, through food, mm-hmm. all of your, because I know you worked with attachment parenting, you had a family bed, and I'm fascinated by these things because I've met your kids and they're awesome. So clearly the things you did were successful for you and your family. Can you talk to me how you came to the decision about a family bed and what is that exactly?
Sure. Well, for me, I grew up in New York City. My parents are in the theater business. They're I had a very unconventional upbringing.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like, well, I kind of grew up okay. I'm well adjusted. Like, what did they do?
Right.
And I didn't honestly know. Apparently, that I had a crib and everything. But my mom's like, yeah, but you were in our bed every night. Oh, and your brother was in our bed till he was 6.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought, okay, well, that worked. And then I also had other people in my life who were doing family bed.
What is it? What is that? What does that mean?
Basically, bed sharing. There's room sharing and there's bed sharing. So
right.
Now we know the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends room sharing as of 2016. Up until a minimum of 6 months, preferably a year.
Wow,
is how they
guys.
Say it. So even if you have your baby in a crib, the AAP recommends
that the crib is in your room.
The crib be in the room. Now, that's obviously not the right answer for everybody.
Sure.
But they came to that decision after a whole, my understanding is, after a lot of pediatricians were reporting
SIDS
some
and
really,
things
yeah,
like that.
SIDS,
scary
stuff. Infant death from kids, from parents that weren't attentive to, let's say they didn't have a monitor or, you know, they were relying
sure.
too much on it or
sure.
wearing noise-canceling headphones or something.
Sure.
So that said, I felt that I just wanted to be close to my baby. I felt that it would be hard to get up out of bed and nurse. Go into another room and take the baby out of the crib and nurse and put the baby back. Right. We also had a small two-bedroom apartment at the time when I had my first kid.
Logistically, that is
logistically, like... you know, it didn't feel like it made a whole lot of sense. The walls were, you know, it was like a 1960s building with paper-thin walls. We would have heard right. the kid anyway.
Right.
And I just wanted to sleep as much as possible because I knew I'd be going back to work and all that. Mm-hmm. I also read a book. I had to write down the title because mm-hmm. I haven't looked at it in so long, but it was called The Continuum Concept by mm-hmm. Jean Liedloff from 1986. I read it probably in 1999 or 2000, way before I thought about having kids. And it's a book by an anthropologist who went into essentially a pre-industrial society and looked at how these parents function and they all wear their babies. So then I looked into attachment parenting and I looked into how that's based on attachment theory. This is
and
all
explain,
way for
yes,
kids.
But explain to our listeners what yeah. exactly is attachment parenting, because you know, there are a lot of these trigger words when you're a new mom or when you're pregnant that you hear, like sleep training, the cry it out method, mm-hmm. attachment parenting, a family bed, co-sleeping. These are all such triggering words that I think are like not... What's fascinating is that you've done some of them, and can you explain what exactly attachment parenting is and
yes,
how it worked for you?
I can. And I feel like I didn't fully explain the answer to your question about family bed.
Yes, we will get that.
So, yeah. So basically bed sharing is parents or caregivers in the same bed as the baby. Room sharing is, maybe there's a sidecar mattress.
So you had
on the
one
floor.
Bed with you yeah. and your husband uh-huh. and your baby.
Yes. And then when the second kid came around, we already had what's called a sidecar, a small infant mattress on the floor, and our king bed was on the floor.
Right next to him.
Yeah. And so that, but then shortly after my second kid was born, they're 2 years apart. He was like, I'm out. I'm in my own room.
On his own.
Oh, yeah. He was like, this is, you know, this waking up in the middle of the night, baby, infant stuff. Like, I'm over
How
it.
Did you
he just marched
with,
into
like,
his own room.
Now, the fear that people have about, like, blankets, sheets, rolling uh-huh. over on your baby. How did mm-hmm. that just not happen?
It doesn't happen. But there are safe sleeping guidelines, yes. and your listeners can look them up from Dr. James McKenna. Mm-hmm. He actually wrote a great book called Sleeping with Your Baby, A Parent's Guide to Co-Sleeping. And so all of that is explained in that book. But, you know, the long and short of it is you don't have a lot of blankets. You don't have blankets over the baby.
Right.
It basically goes the breastfeeding parent uh-huh. and the baby, some sort of bed rail or wall, uh-huh. baby, breastfeeding parent, and then other parent.
Oh.
So we actually, that's the best way to do it. That's actually not what we ended up doing.
Your bed was in the middle of the room.
Because of the configuration of the room.
Right.
We had dad on one side, baby in the middle, and me. And we just... Baby didn't have our comforter over him. Right. We made a U shape with the comforter.
Got it.
Or we had two separate comforters depending on the time of year. You know, here we are in Los Angeles.
Right. You don't really are sleeping with heavy, heavy stuff.
Yeah. It's different than.
And so when the baby would wake up and make sounds, you would just roll over and lay down,
yeah,
breastfeed.
Baby is right there. So the beauty of it is that, you know, with cue feeding overnight, is baby goes, you know, and roots. And even at 8 weeks, self attaches. And I'm like, oh, I guess he's nursing. And you wake up and then. You're done and you go back to sleep.
Wow.
Yeah. So the nursing hormones, the oxytocin and all those feel-good hormones really help me as the breastfeeding mom to go back to sleep.
Sure.
And then you do that in a safe way by not, you don't, obviously, there's a suffocation hazard if there's a big blanket over the baby.
Of course.
So we would have our own little baby blanket over him or a sleep sack or
something,
you know,
like that.
Various things depending on the time of year. If it was warm, then baby would just be in a sleeper without any blankets.
And then when you gave birth to your second baby, mm-hmm. how did the bed look there?
So
I find this so fascinating.
Yeah. So my toddler was still nursing. I breastfed through my whole second pregnancy.
Oh, yeah. You guys, Abigail's the champion who tandem breastfed,
yes.
FYI.
Yeah.
You ever heard of that?
I did.
That's two babies, one on each boob.
Yeah. Not always at the same time, although they were at the same time sometimes. It was just the second pregnancy was not, it took us by surprise. So they were 2 years apart. So
it's amazing.
The older kid who was two when the second one was born was at that time from 18 months, from his age, 18 months until baby two was born, he was sleeping in a sidecar arrangement. So he was on the floor in a small organic
mattress.
Baby mattress. Yeah, next to our bed. So we would put him down at his bedtime, 6:30 or 7 or whatever it was. And then we would go leave the room and go about our night.
And then we would just go in and sleep in the family bed. And so when baby two was born, and I had both kids at home. So baby number two was born, but my birth was super, super fast. The whole thing was about an hour.
My
husband had been putting my older kid to bed, the two-year-old, while I was realizing, oh, holy shit, I'm in labor.
Oh, my God.
And then, you know, an hour later, the baby's born in the kitchen in a water birth. This was a planned home birth, I should say, with a nurse midwife. So then the next morning, my son met the new baby, and he just kind of toddled out of his little sidecar bed. I think I had slept in the couch pullout that night. Whatever sleep
you
was happened after giving birth.
Like superwoman. I can't even.
It's just what made sense. I mean, and so when shortly after you asked how the sleep looked when number two was born. So we co-slept with her. And then after the first couple nights, it became clear, okay, so toddler really needs to continue having this 11 hour straight sleep, which he had been getting. And my husband needed sleep. And so I slept in the twin bed in my son's room, which he hadn't even moved into yet.
Right.
This was our two bedroom house.
Right.
We'd upgraded, but it was still only two bedrooms.
Right.
And so I slept in the twin bed with my daughter, the newborn, so that she could cue feed. That said, she would go 3-4 hours straight from newborn age, which, you know, you can't really let a newborn go more than 4 hours if you want to breastfeed. So I had to sometimes wake her. But she was a totally different type of breastfeeder than her older brother was. And they are to this day. They eat in very different ways. They have different metabolisms.
Wow.
Where he was just, you know, like a hummingbird nursing frequently. And she was like, oh, whatever, I'm like fast asleep.
How did you?
And then we all went into the family bed. I don't know, she was maybe a month old. I brought her back into the family bed.
Right.
And then my son was like,
twin.
I'm out. I want to
Right, right, right. He was 2 years old and he was like,
he
forget
was two.
This.
He was
this
like,
is
I
insane.
Do not
Mom's
want this.
Up every 4 hours or less.
Yeah. And I don't even know if he knew that I was up because, you know, it's quiet. It's not like the child is screaming.
Right.
You
right.
feed them when they're hungry.
Right.
But he just, I think that he was so completely appalled that there was another child who had joined the family.
Right.
He's like, I'm going to just pretend this isn't happening.
Sure.
Go into
my
own
space. I need my own space.
And so we gave that to him.
How did you find, how is it on a relationship?
You know, I think that
like
it's
I imagine
for
in my head the cozy moments of like, you know, because I didn't do, Albie was, I was really, really sick after I gave birth. I had probably the worst cold and cough I've ever had in my entire life. And so Albie was sleeping in his crib outside of my room from day one, with a night nurse. And I really still romanticize the idea of like the whole family being in a bed and all of these things. But realistically, since you have done it for a long time, you had a family bed. How does that look with your relationship? Like with your husband, is it like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm sure it looks different for every family.
Sure.
I know it does because I have a lot of friends and family members who've done family bed, and many of them even longer than we did. So I'm just going to speak from my own experience. Mm-hmm. But it was amazing when my first one was born.
I knew it!
You know, it really was. And this is a kid who physiologically needed to eat every 45 minutes to hour and a half until he was about a year old. That was just who he is, and he would get super full fast. This kid as a newborn could drain a breast in 5 minutes.
Wow.
And then he was out cold.
For you guys, like it would take
That's
me
unusual.
Sometimes at the beginning, I would be breastfeeding for 35, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
For...
And I remember asking my midwife, who was also, you know, a lactation expert, like, what about 20 minutes per side? Isn't it supposed to be? She's like, honey, watch the baby, not the clock.
Right.
And that was the best advice I got.
Right.
So in the light of all of these repeated surges of oxytocin and the feel-good hormones that, you know, our brain has the pituitary gland, which is between our eyes and the forehead, secretes oxytocin, which stimulates uterine contractions. So that's part of what helps the uterus go back to its normal size after giving birth.
Right.
And also stimulates that prolactin comes from there too, stimulates the milk letdown. So every time you get that surge of oxytocin, the prolactin milk letdown, you know, it feels kind of like being high. You know,
so
like
your
I experimented
whole...
a little bit in college. I mean, I can just say it's, you know, it's a really heady or like a post-orgasmic feeling, except it's not sexual. It's
right.
just really feeling.
So you're all in this bed feeling
so
good.
Swimming in the, you know,
in the Michel O'Donnell,
the cocktail of mother hormones.
That's what you were feeling. And he was feeling it too.
I also felt a lot of anxiety.
Right.
My husband and I were talking about this the other day, that he's like, do you remember when we could... You drop a fork in the kitchen and we would panic because we thought he was going to wake up because he was such a light sleeper.
Oh, I can't. I mean, I'm very, oh my gosh.
Yeah. So the first time was amazing, but it was also, it also was not without its challenges.
Did you feel that you got quality? It sounds like you got quality sleep in this situation because you weren't having to get out of bed. I remember that, to like go breastfeed. Like for you going back to work, it was all about logging the most amount of minutes possible to sleep. And that would mean having the baby right there next to you means you're not getting up out of bed to get the baby out of the crib.
Yeah.
To then
and
put
it's
the baby
skin
back down.
To skin. It's better, you know, regulation of the breastfeeding mechanism. The, you know, the letdown reflex happens sooner when your baby's right next to you. And then baby wearing, which we did during the day.
And this is all in regards to attachment parenting is what we're talking about. Can you explain a little bit about what that means?
Yes, absolutely. Well, there's the 8 principles of attachment parenting can be found from attachmentparenting.org, which is a not-for-profit organization. But basically, it's based on attachment theory, which goes way, way back. But it's the psychological model that describes relationships between humans. And attachment theory is now the primary, the dominant theory used in child development, in infant and toddler mental health. This is what psychotherapists use. It's called attachment theory. And so we look at it in the West in terms of the dyad, like the mother-infant dyad. But really, we need to look at the whole world and see that in most cultures, it's not a nuclear family.
Right.
We're kind of, forgive me, we're kind of fucked in that way
totally.
In this world.
Right.
Because this whole idea of it's like one or two parents raising kids.
Is not,
no,
you guys, takes a village.
It's a village.
It really, really is true. Yes.
And so attachment parenting looks at being having a primary caregiver, which usually ends up being the mother who gave birth, but it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. I had a good friend whose wife went back to work at Disney as a producer, like 6 weeks after giving birth, and they were attachment parenting. So they co-slept, but he was the baby wearing dad, and he was at the park with us, and
that's awesome.
All of that. And so it doesn't have to be just a mom, and
so
it doesn't have to be a biological
parenting
mom.
Basically means like that the baby is always close to you in proximity.
Yeah, always and most of the time. So baby wearing allows you to kind of go about your day while having the baby close to you. Baby would sleep on me. We baby wore, I had like 14 different baby carriers.
Whoa.
And so some in the beginning were more appropriate to an infant. And then as the baby
some older.
Grew, yeah. And then once I had, you know, I got pregnant, I was wearing him more on my back. And then co-sleeping or bed sharing.
You are.
And cue feeding.
Wow. Okay. So explain cue feeding. This is also a whole thing. And then I want to get into a little bit about how you naturally got your babies sort of on a schedule on their own.
Yeah.
And because you did end up going, you went back to work.
Yeah. After the first kid, I went back to work about 3.5 months after giving birth. But I'm my own business owner. So I wasn't going back to work in a 9-to-6 corporate office with an hour commute each way.
Right. You were having your own hours that you planned. So you practice co-sleeping, attachment parenting. Mm-hmm. You would sleep with the baby on you for naps in your bed at night, and then you would wear him and her as you did stuff throughout the day.
I should point out when my husband was the primary caregiver when I went back to work, he would do the baby wearing, and on the weekends we both would. And then when we had a babysitter, they would wear the baby.
Did you find there to be any sort of huge separation that happened, or does the baby just decide like, Mom, I don't want to be warm, like, you know, when they start to be really separate?
Oh yeah,
what
they
does
tell
that
you.
Look like?
They
oh, they tell you.
You.
See,
yeah, it's clear. You know, basically, I feel that it's important to look at the brain and brain development, and so when attachment theory looks at how an infant responds when they are separated from their primary caregiver. Right. And so in Africa, in certain countries that are, we might call pre-industrial, you know,
sure.
where they still have spacing on the word for it, but there's multiple mothers in the village.
I saw
this. This still goes on in many parts
of course,
the world.
Of course it does.
This idea of solitary sleep is less than 100 years old.
Whoa.
So to kind of just put that in perspective, if you think of how long we've been around as a human race. So if a child is separated by themselves in the dark, scared, that goes into, what's called our implicit memory. Mm. So they look at it. This is more of a Dr. Dan Siegel, who's a psychotherapist and neurobiologist here in California. But looking at how the brain works, the amygdala, the hippocampus, the parts of brain that store our raw sensory memory. Mm-hmm. This is the stuff that's, you know, pre-verbal. But if you, let's say a child is attacked by a bear, you know, just because they're 3 months doesn't mean they're not going to remember it.
Right.
Because
right,
it goes into implicit memory.
It goes in there somewhere, of course.
Right.
Of course.
And so the same thing happens when a child is, you know,
by themselves.
Left alone. Yeah. And so the idea is not to never leave your child alone. But with attachment parenting, we are fostering.
You're really looking for their cues of when they are ready. Like, you carried this baby mm-hmm. inside of you when they were not alone for 10 months, and now the baby's outside of you, and you keep them close, and they will make it clear with and when they are ready for any sort of distance. Is that sort of the...
Well, yes, but also when the mom or the dad or the parents are ready for distance, exactly, for whatever it is, you know, there's a soothing approach so that the child is associating going to sleep with being safe.
Right.
If the child associates going to sleep with being in a state of terror and fear, then you can bet that kid's going to have problems later on in life with those implicit memories.
Got it.
So I saw that a lot because I worked with moms for so long before I became a parent. Mm-hmm. And I saw that and I just didn't want that.
You knew in your heart that that was not, like, you were never going to be, for example, this whole cry it out method or letting babies really cry when they go to sleep, fundamentally and psychologically to you, that didn't sit right.
Yeah, to me and my husband. And we talked about it quite a lot, especially in pregnancy.
You just knew that you were going to always put your baby to sleep in a state of comfort and peace and safety.
Yeah, that was the idea. And then when eventually I night weaned my oldest child when he was about 17 months, we used the Dr. Jay Gordon, who's a pediatrician on the west side of California, Santa Monica, rather. West side of L.A.
West side of California. All of California is the west side, but yes. So what did you say?
And that approach is picking a seven-hour chunk, because the definition of sleeping through the night is about 7 hours, mm-hmm. You know, for a child under about a year. And he says, do not use this method under, like, 12 to 14 months.
Okay.
But we picked a 7 hour chunk because I was just tired of nursing all night through my pregnancy, honestly. Like, that point.
Who
16,
are you?
17 like, months
I
old.
I literally do not. I'm sitting here, you guys. I'm probably the most quiet I've ever been in any of the podcasts because my mouth is on the floor, just agape at, like, and that you look pretty and you're, like, well rested and you did all of this. I just can't even imagine it. Okay. So.
Well, they do eventually sleep. But yeah, the idea was pick a 7 hour chunk. And he says, you know, 11 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
And when instead of, it's gradual, but it for us, it took about a week and we did it with both kids.
What
but,
did you
so
do?
Instead of nursing to sleep, you breastfeed. And then after 11 p.m., you don't breastfeed at all. And so you do shushing and patting their back, but it's still within the family bed. So this approach is fantastic if you're doing family bed, but you're ready to night wean your kid.
Right, because you're making them still feel safe and comforted, yes. But not through food and nursing anymore.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be the, quote, primary parent. It doesn't have to be the mom, as long as everybody's on the same page and you're really clear on your guidelines.
So when did you start to see a schedule? I'm assuming it started to naturally form.
Yeah.
Because then you went back to work, and I know that your baby was cared for by your husband and then also at daycare and things like that.
Yeah.
Like, how did you continue this sort of methodology with really basically being sort of on demand and taking things off of cues of your baby when other people are involved?
Right. Well, we did daycare didn't start until 18 months.
Okay.
So I didn't have the experience of infant daycare, which I know a lot of people who have, but I went back to work 3 days a week, and 2 days my husband was the primary parent, and then one day we had a babysitter.
And you guys completely saw eye to eye, like, he could do it, no problem.
Yeah, we did, and we still do.
And he would just feed a bottle before naps?
So the idea with cue feeding is that whether you're bottle feeding or you're breastfeeding, if you have listeners who really tried to breastfeed but can't, you can absolutely still do cue feeding.
Sure.
Whether it's with breast milk, your own breast milk that's pumped, donor milk, formula, whatever it is, it's food.
And cue feeding is basically like you think they're hungry, they're expressing that they're hungry,
yeah,
you feed them.
You learn their cues pretty quickly, just like you do with when they need to poop, mm-hmm. which is a whole other conversation, maybe for another episode. But so I went back to work at 3.5 months after baby number one was born. And at that point, he had really, around, I think, about 3 months, he settled into a pretty predictable pattern.
Yeah.
Of breastfeeding, of sleep. And I believe rhythm and routine are so important. I love that sort of Waldorf approach of rhythm and routine, of, you know, or Rudolf Steiner, of babies love routine. It can be, you know, looking at the baby's cues, just like I explained my first kid and my second kid, totally different metabolisms.
Right.
You know, one needed to
eat
every hour and the other one could
totally
go 4 hours.
For a while, right.
By 6 months was going, like, much, much longer. So we would watch their cues, and then if it was a caregiver there, they would give a bottle of breast milk, and then, you know, often wear the baby or bounce on a ball and put them down to sleep in their bed and then go about their business.
And so you were at a daycare and they weren't on a set schedule, for example, like they weren't saying like, we do nap time here from 1 to 2.
Oh yeah, but daycare wasn't until 18 months.
Okay, so yeah, by that time the baby was set.
Yeah, a 1.5 year old. Yeah, by the time he started daycare, he was probably waking up once a night, maybe twice a night to nurse. Mm-hmm. No, that's actually because we night weaned at 17, 18 months. So he was waking more frequently. But basically the full three full days a week of daycare when that started was about the time he was sleeping straight through the night, 11 hours straight. So no, they had a set nap time, 1 to 2:30. And I said, how the heck are you going to get 14 kids to nap at the same time? And they said, oh, it happens. And, they're incredibly loving and they sit there and they pat their backs. And then it's contagious. All the kids are in one room.
Yeah, once one and your two go, they all start to go.
Yeah.
Turn on that white noise.
Exactly. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
So.
What have you found to be the benefits of co-sleeping?
So the advantages are basically from when they night weaned, stopped nursing overnight, but continued nursing during the day, they have not had any sleep regressions at all.
Wow.
And so, and they have positive associations with sleep.
They're not afraid of it. They're not getting in a dark room and freaking out.
The biggest issue now is, but mom, I'm not done with this chapter. They want to keep reading. And we have a firm lights out, rule. And I know you want to keep reading. So I really take an empathy-based approach to parenting, and that just grows with them. Now they're in second and fourth grade, and their sleep is absolutely crucial. So if anything, it's they don't want to go to bed soon enough, even if they're still like in bed at 7:30. That's a hard out for us, but they may be reading for an hour and a half. And so, we have to turn
off
the light.
They're in bed at 7:30, mm-hmm. and then they go to sleep at 9. They might read till 9.
Well, I mean, my daughter's out by 8:15 most nights, but my son will push it as late as we
can. Can I be your kid? This is unbelievable. Like, that sounds
Well, they have
freaking
to be up at 6:30
delicious.
For school. So, yeah. And I'm in bed by 9:30.
Wow.
I treat a lot of insomnia in my practice, and a lot of the adults I work with did not have healthy sleep hygiene as kids. And so I think sleep hygiene, however that's defined, it looks different for every family, is super important for setting us up as adults, because the brain is so malleable. It's not fully myelinated until age 7.
What advice would you give to parents who might be looking into making a choice like this?
The number one piece of advice I would give is trust your instinct. Trust your intuition, because it's never wrong.
Mm.
And if you are married, because a lot of the people I work with are going about this alone, single moms by choice. But if you, with your partner or the person that you're deciding to raise your kids with, make sure that you talk about all these questions first.
Right.
Not all of them, but many of them. What do you want parenting to look like?
Right. Did you do that with your husband?
I did.
Like, you guys knew while you were pregnant, you had spoken about a family bed and attachment parenting, and you had read books and done all that kind of thing.
I mean, it was kind of hilarious. My mother-in-law, God bless her, threw me a baby shower with a whole bunch of her friends that I had never met. And before
Classic.
This, she said, so what's the nursery? Like, what is your color theme? And I said, well, we're not going to have a nursery because we have a two-bedroom apartment, and one of the bedrooms was our office.
Right.
And the other was our bedroom, she's like, okay, well, are you going to find out the gender? I'm like, well, we're not going to find out gender because there's no test for gender in utero, but we elected not to choose to find out the sex for my first, so we didn't know. So I literally got like 30 fantastic gifts that were all pink or green. And my mother-in-law knit this adorable white baby blanket for my son with a Raider patch on it, because my husband's a huge Raider fan. She's determined to have something in there.
Something.
So she's like, if I can't have a pink color,
I can have a blanket with a Raider emblem on it.
I love her.
So the real thing, it's trust your instinct, it's wonderful that I'm sitting here listening to you, because I am such a Libra in that.
Yeah, or you maybe and me both.
I'm just like very good at weighing out. Like, I love being a part of this podcast because I love hearing how people do things. Mm-hmm. And I also really am able to see, weigh things out. And so for me, instinctually, it can get hard because I'm like, well, I'm feeling this, but maybe it's that, but maybe it's this, but maybe it's that.
Yeah.
Ugh.
You know, it's so good that you say that because as a Libra, I have same thing. I'm always wanting to know the yin and the yang of things, the plus and the minus, the cost benefit ratio.
Right.
You know?
Totally. And the pros and cons list, baby.
Exactly. And for a new parent or, you know, maybe a parent who had a kid 9-10 years ago and is going to be doing it all over again and thinking maybe I'll do things different, you know, go to the library, get books, just
Yeah, you guys, FYI, Abigail's brought up so many amazing points in this podcast that will all be listed in the crib notes.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And just, I think, follow your instinct and follow your inclination to learn more about something. And ultimately, you are the expert about your baby.
Right.
Nobody else is. And it for me, resisting the mommy wars brought on a lot of anxiety. Mm. I felt judged whether or not I was actually being judged. I would feel anxious. Am I doing what's best for my kid? Mm. Can I be any better? But I've learned now, almost 10 years into this, to just to surrender and let it go and detach with love and find acceptance with that uncertainty. Because ultimately, you know, we really can't control our kids. We can set healthy boundaries.
I can try, but no.
Absolutely. We can set healthy boundaries and, you know, have a really good rhythm and routine in our day and all that. And then ultimately, I truly think a lot of the personality just come into the world with it.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, God bless
my mom. I've babysat enough kids in this town to know that a lot of them just kind of came out who they were. It's really weird.
They absolutely did. Yeah. My mom and dad read this book by T. Barry Brazelton, who just passed away at age 99 a couple months ago.
Whoa.
And he's, you know, a world famous guy. But he was like the pediatrician in the post-Spock era who was started talking about this attachment theory and all that. And my mom was like, I don't know, it just made so much sense. And it was totally different from what her parents had done with their six children. And that was, I saw she's like, she found a book, it lit a fire. You know, she said she felt like the only person in the world who'd ever had a baby. She was an actress in New York. None of her friends had kids.
Right.
So I took a cue from my mom, I think, and just following my instinct, learning more about it, and then ultimately just letting it go and you know.
Reading your baby and getting to know your baby and trusting that you know what's best for him.
And sometimes I was on the floor hysterically crying, you know? I mean, that's the reality of it.
Well, parenting, I think no matter what you choose, whichever ways, and just because you choose something one day doesn't mean you can't change your mind another day also,
absolutely.
By the way. Just, but at some point, you're all going to be crying on the floor, and at some point, you're all going to be laughing your asses off, and that's just seems to be motherhood.
It is. And whether it's a biological child or an adopted child or, you know, a grandchild or whatever, it's that same dynamic.
For sure.
You have to just surrender into that powerlessness, I think.
I was actually just away with Albie and we had him nap in the bed with us for fun. And I felt like I couldn't really like get into a comfortable position. Honestly, like I was like, what about the blankets? I know we've already talked about this, but is that just something in time that you sort of figure out the best way position wise to sleep with your baby in the bed? Or was there something that you know works every time that's like written in a book?
Well, you know, I will refer you back to the Dr. James McKenna guidelines for safe co-sleeping because he gives good guidelines in general for everybody, but, and to avoid SIDS and all of that. But I think what I tell my patients too, especially if they're dealing with insomnia and a new baby, is find whatever's comfortable for you first, exclusive of the baby. I personally am a side sleeper. I've always slept on my left side. That's how I sleep, except my mom says when I was a baby, I slept on my tummy. Mm-hmm. I you know, find your pillow blanket combo on the mattress and then figure out how baby can work around that in a safe way so that, for example, with me, I would tuck the blanket under my leg so it wasn't anywhere near baby. And it also has to be a firm mattress. We can't be dealing with a mushy mattress here or a big cushy mattress cover. Mm-hmm. Those don't fit the safe co-sleeping guidelines. So we had a super firm mattress, which is what we liked anyway. So find where your comfortable spot is. And then if that's, it kind of is easiest on the side because this is all keeping in mind that I learned how to nurse on my side very early. Once the baby
I think
has
you taught
control.
Me how to nurse on my side, actually.
Yeah, I remember
Abigail
that.
Came over to do a postpartum tune-up acupuncture session. And she was like, oh, you can just lay right here and put the baby right here. And I was like, you can lay down and nurse. I only thought in the hospital, I had only learned that there was a football hold or the cradle hold.
Right.
I had no clue.
There's
you could
so
like
many
lay down and nurse. So
yeah.
You would be sleeping on the side. You get comfortable and figure out how the baby works into that. Because yeah. if you're sleeping well and mm-hmm. comfortably, so is the baby.
Right. And I basically lined up baby nose to nipple, or he was a little bit lower. Uh-huh. And that was what was comfortable for me. Babies are very resilient. They will pretty much sleep anywhere. And so the advantage of bed sharing was that, you know, we did travel to see family, or we went on vacation, or we were in a hotel or whatever.
And it would always do the same for
and
the baby.
And it would just, the baby would just sleep where we slept, you know? And this whole idea of, a lot of people think, oh, family bed means you go to bed when the kid goes to bed. No. You know, when they were really little, bedtime was 6 o'clock.
Sure.
We would put the kid down to 6 o'clock, and then I would like rush to do laundry and make dinner and all of that stuff. The dirty secret of parenting is that that window narrows, you know, and then you end up with so much less time.
I cannot. But right now, Allie goes to sleep at 7, and yeah. I really, my 7 to 10 window yeah. is like huge for me right
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
Especially
I remember
it's
that.
Like, you know, when I see my husband and like
right.
when I have a 5 glasses
right.
of wine
yeah.
or whatever. But like.
Well, the other thing is you get creative with where you are intimate with your partner. You know, I mean, it's not just me.
Imagine.
I've talked to other people.
Yeah,
about
no,
this.
You have to.
Especially when you have the second kid.
You have
and after
to.
The second kid comes, you know, it's super important not to lose that intimacy in that one-on-one time. Date night became crucial.
This has been so eye-opening and so wonderful. And you are, I'm just so happy to be sitting with you in my crib on my couch.
We both fit.
You're the best. You're just the best. And thank you so much for all of your wise words and advice and personal experience. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode. I want to hear from you. Let's chat. Questions, comments, concerns? Let me know. You can always find me at katiescrib@shondaland.com. Katie's Crib is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. This season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.